United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. I admonish to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-5354. Carlos Moreno, appellant, Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, as a component of the Department of Justice, DOJ.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Doug Keller. I'm a fellow in the Georgetown Appellate Litigation Clinic. The clinic was appointed amicus in this case, and with the court's permission, arguing on behalf of amicus will be Sebastian Ruiz, who's a third-year law student at Georgetown and who's appearing in this court pursuant to this court's rules.
We'll hear from you, Mr. Ruiz.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'd like to save 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
We'll see.
In amicus's view, the district court erred in denying the Rule 60B6 motion solely on the basis that there are no defenses to the motion for summary judgment. The record establishes that there were two independent defenses, one under the public domain doctrine and another by Moreno's asserting
Why was it taking so long to bring this? I mean, timeliness is an element of a Rule 60 motion. This is an active litigant, right? I mean, he's monitoring carefully what his lawyer's doing, and yet after the denial of summary judgment, he doesn't file this for a considerable amount of time. I've forgotten. How much time was it between the denial of summary judgment and the bringing of this motion?
Two and a half years.
What?
Yes, Your Honor. During that time, not too long after the motion was granted as conceded, there was a pending motion before the district court from Mr. Moreno's attorney for reconsideration. And had the court acted and granted that motion, that would have obviated the need for Mr. Moreno to file a motion for reconsideration or a Rule 60 motion, essentially seeking the same relief. So because the court waited so long to grant that, to rule on that motion, it's arguably reasonable for Mr. Moreno to have waited.
Remind me, what was the period of time between when the court denied that motion for reconsideration and he brought his Rule 60 motion?
The court denied both motions in the same opinion, time. Your Honor. So it's arguably reasonable for Mr. Moreno to wait. And this is an issue that's committed to the discretion of the district court. So because there is that reason, we believe that it should be remanded for the court to exercise its discretion. The court only ruled strictly on the Rule 60 requirement that there be a meritorious defense to summary judgment, and it found that there were no defenses. But we,
assuming we were to grant relief, does the public domain doctrine get you anything beyond what is already in the public domain?
Your Honor, because the public domain doctrine here is operating to attack the basis for the Glomar response, then
let's assume it gets you past the Glomar response. Do you get any paper beyond what you already have access to from the two prior criminal proceedings?
Yes, Your Honor, beyond the Glomar response, if there are documents for which the contents are unprotected by one of the 9 FOIA exemptions, then those would be disclosed.
Right. Now, I don't think that's where we are, though.
That's correct.
We're in a world where the Exemption 7C, you're saying the reason public domain comes in is the documents are protected. If they weren't protected, you wouldn't need public domain, right?
That's right.
Right. Now, we're assuming then that the exemption does apply. And it looks to me like it does, frankly. So what do you get beyond what's already in the public domain? Aren't we doing a vain thing if we send it back?
Well, you get the disclosure of knowing what documents exist or do not exist that are responsive to
your
request.
Do you even get that? I mean, would it not be, assume again the government asserts the 7C, assume a judge calls for an index, reviews it in camera, have you really gotten anything that you don't have now? I mean, the rationale that gives you what's already been disclosed is one thing. To say it gives you something beyond what's been disclosed, quite enough.
Well, so The 7C exemption has been asserted globally to protect the GLOMAR response, which is refusing to confirm or deny the existence of any documents. And if that global GLOMAR response falls, then when the documents within the file are reviewed, it could be the case that some of the documents within the file are not protected by Exemption 7C. So to give you a hypothetical, assume that there were only two documents in the file. One was a rap sheet, and the other was a copy of a transcript of testimony given by Mr. Lopez at Moreno's trial. If that were the case, then the rap sheet would indeed be protected by Exemption 7C, and its contents would not be disclosed. However, there's no presumable basis for protecting the trial testimony because it wouldn't be protected by one of the 9 FOIA exemptions.
But don't you already have the trial testimony?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Don't you already have the trial testimony?
Well, that was just in theory, Your Honor. If there's something that's unprotected within the file, the point is that that would be disclosed once GLOMAR falls. Now, our argument is that there's at least a genuine issue of material fact that the information linking Mr. Lopez, the witness at Moreno's trial, to the NATIS number is in the public domain. And this is because viewing the attachments to Mr. Moreno's complaint in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, the 3 DEA-6 documents that are in the record that were made that bear a label as government exhibits in a related public criminal trial each raise that genuine issue of material fact that because they state Mr. Lopez's name and they connect him to a NATIS number that shows his status as one who has files in his name, and that was the sole articulated justification for DEA's for use of the GLOMAR response in the DEA declaration. If that information is in the public domain, just as a matter of common sense, it no longer can be protected. Now, if I may, I would like to move to the defense under the by asserting a public interest. Because DEA's motion for summary judgment and—
If we agree with you on the public domain issue, that raised a material fact dispute that was meritorious, we don't need to get to this issue, is that right? Or would we?
I'm sorry, what was the beginning of your question, Your Honor?
Do we need to, if we agree with you that there's a fact issue that was raised on the public domain issue, do we need to take up this issue? Or?
No, these are independent defenses, okay, Your Honor. On this second independent basis for a defense, because both the DEA motion for summary judgment and the district court's opinion basically looked past the allegations in Moreno's complaint that were styled under a public interest of uncovering government wrongdoing under the standard the Supreme Court established in Favish, and instead basically claimed that this was nothing more than a private interest in overturning his criminal conviction, then there is a defense if this court simply finds that Moreno asserted a valid public interest under Favish. So if I may, because the question is, was there a defense to the motion for summary judgment, I'd like to read you the language from DEA's motion for summary judgment. Quote, plaintiff seeks the documents for no other purpose than to challenge his conviction. Plaintiff's allegations notwithstanding, his stated purpose for his desire to obtain documents relating to the number does not count as a public interest. And the district court basically bought this framing of the case, and the district court concludes, quote, plaintiff's grounds his invocation of the public interest exception entirely in his speculation that the information sought could potentially contain exculpatory information. This is a mischaracterization also, and the district court never once cited Favish or went through the multiple allegations in Moreno's complaint, but rather instead considered them to be merely a search for exculpatory information.
But what is the public interest here, and wouldn't every criminal defendant have the same argument?
Your Honor, the public interest is, if I may read the standard from Favish, in showing that the investigative agency or other responsible officials acted negligently or otherwise improperly in the performance of their duties.
But if you're a criminal defendant and you're actually trying to show that you were wrongfully convicted or that, you know, there was a problem with your case, it seems to me your private interest is always going to be consistent with the public interest in that sense, right? You're arguing that they did something wrong.
Then the fact that the private interest may be aligned or consistent, Your Honor, is not what's at issue. The Supreme Court has stated in Reporters Committee, and this court has stated in Roth, that the private interest is not to be considered. It's merely whether or not there can be found to be a public interest. Now, if I may read Moreno's most substantive
just so I understand, is the issue that you're arguing that there's a difference between when someone is wrongfully convicted and when they're wrongfully convicted based on government misconduct? Is that the distinction you're trying to make, or?
Your Honor, we're not discussing, the allegations are not necessarily grounded in that there's been a wrongful conviction. The most substantive allegation is that there was negligence on the part of DEA and DOJ in investigating Mr. Lopez, who was used as a government witness against Moreno at trial. And that led to perjury, which we know to have existed.
I'm just trying to find a distinction in answer to Judge Brown's good question about how do you separate this case from any other case in which a criminal defendant is convicted. I mean, aren't they all going to claim I was wrongfully convicted and that's breach of public trust and wrongdoing by the government? How can you avoid that?
By requiring what Favish requires, that the allegations be particularized and supported by facts. And then beyond that...
Allegations of what?
The allegations of wrongdoing in this case are of government negligence in investigating Mr. Lopez. So, quote, I'm reading from the complaint, quote, DEA acted...
If that's the rule, don't you just then invite every criminal defendant who's convicted to bring a FOIA request and use that language?
If they're using that language, the Supreme Court requires that in order to support the finding that it is actually a valid public interest, there be enough evidence such that a reasonable person would believe that government misconduct might have occurred. So there is that fail-safe that's been included as well. The pleading standards would have to be met. So you couldn't just say there's been negligence or government wrongdoing, but you would have to supply particularized facts to get past the pleading standard.
But let's suppose that the government wrongdoing was a Brady violation, right? Which normally we wouldn't try to go after under FOIA, but if we agree with you, wouldn't that be a legitimate basis for saying there was government malfeasance, right? And so there's a public interest.
Under the standard the Supreme Court has established, yes, Your Honor, it looks like that would be the case. And this court has not fully decided that issue. The only time that this court said a single Brady violation would not be enough was in Aguaju, which was vacated by Favish. And then this court in Martin passed on that question because the case was balanced on the sufficiency of the public interest showing. There was not enough evidence to support government wrongdoing. And most recently in Blackwell, on a concurring opinion, Judge Rogers stated that this court has still not said that it would not be government wrongdoing when there is a showing of a Brady violation. I see my time has expired.
We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ruiz, we'll hear from the government. May proceed, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jane Lyons on behalf of the Drug Enforcement Administration. The district court granted DEA's motion for summary judgment in this case as conceded because Moreno's counsel failed to file any opposition to it. Because it acted on the basis of its published local rule and the record fails to demonstrate any extraordinary circumstances or gross negligence on the part of Moreno's counsel, the district court acted comfortably within its discretion by granting DEA's motion and essentially by denying...
The district court didn't grant the motion based on any of those factors. It said we're granting the motion because there was no meritorious defense to summary judgment. If they had granted it on those basis, your case would be stronger, wouldn't it? They rested it solely on the fact that there was no meritorious defense to the summary judgment motion.
That was the basis of the district court's denial of the Rule 60B motion, Your Honor.
That's what's before us, right?
That is part of what's before you. It depends on whether you deem whether the underlying grant of the summary judgment motion is before you. Depends on whether the Marino's counsel filed a timely motion for reconsideration, and there's an argument that he did. So I'm out of an abundance of caution seeking affirmance of both. But to direct myself more to the issue that you're focused on, which is the denial of the 60B, it is correct that the district court grounded its decision in the lack of a meritorious defense to the summary judgment motion, yes. Nevertheless, I do want to point out that the court has consistently upheld the application of the local rule in FDIC versus Bender and Fox versus American Airlines. In denying the relief under Rule 60B, the district court correctly found that Marino failed to demonstrate a meritorious claim, finding that the DEA's Glomar response was proper. In this regard,
it does seem a bit silly that DEA is saying we can neither confirm nor deny that we have something that has not been on the public record two or three times. That's the least convincing Glomar response I've seen in 25 years here, I think.
Well, the court's precedents, Your Honor, have clearly held in cases like Kimberlin versus DOJ that a person who testifies in a criminal trial does not give up or surrender their privacy rights in the rest of the government's files.
I am aware of that. I'm also aware that they filed a Glomar response that said we neither can confirm nor deny that we have this information that we've disclosed on the public record three times. Does that not strike you as a bit unconvincing at the least?
I can see an argument that our point that it is somewhat inconsistent, but it is imperative to protect.
If we have an understatement contest, you get to enter that one.
There are a lot of verbal contests I could win, Your Honor, but this morning I'm focused on, basically the government has to prosecute criminals, and they don't usually get to call the nuns and the priests and the teachers in the community. It's the drug co-defendants, just like this
typical
case. You
would neither confirm nor deny that, though, would you?
I could neither confirm nor deny that. That's correct. The point here is that Favish requires more than an assertion of government wrongdoing. It requires a meaningful evidentiary showing, enough to inspire a belief in a reasonable person that there's been some government impropriety here that goes above and beyond low-level government employees.
You seem to be jumping all the way to merits on your argument. You're not conceding that the judge could have erred in the very procedural context of whether to grant the Rule 60 motion at all. You're going all the way to we have a meritorious defense.
Well, there are three things mm-hmm. that the district court usually looks at when it confronts a 60B motion. Mm-hmm. Timeliness, whether there's a meritorious claim or defense, and some sort of extraordinary circumstances are required. On this record, the district court focused on the one of the three. This court can affirm on any of the three grounds, and I would submit respectfully that none of the three are satisfied here.
What
so I'm not conceding.
Just looking discreetly at the question of the attorney neglect here, what should the appellate court do in the case where an attorney has not filed? He said, I prepared but didn't file a response to the summary judgment motion. But what should we do with that?
We should, as counsel and members of the bar, regret those circumstances, but leave it to the attorney-client relationship and the discipline procedures of the bar and other such matters. The importance of the local rule for the district court is to manage its docket. That's an essential function. This court has recognized that this rule serves. And a counsel who files three extensions for more time to file an opposition and then fails to, the district court just has to move its day along a little bit more than that. And the court should stick to that policy.
Just so I am sure that I understand, are you agreeing that the Glomar response was inappropriate here, or are you still defending it?
I am absolutely still defending it, Your Honor. This is a routine drug conspiracy trial with a co-defendant who testified against another person, and that's the best you can make out of this record. What we really have here is a FOIA request for information about a third party who, although it's identified by a narcotics and dangerous drug information system number, it's essentially a request for documents from a third party without any proof of waiver of privacy or proof of death.
Well, I can see the argument that that the contents of that file might still be protected, But the fact of the file, which is part of what the Glomar response is about, are you arguing that that's still protected?
Right.
Given that there are documents in the Mr. Marino's possession, I will still uphold that because I have no way of knowing how he obtained those records.
Everything you're saying seems to be a good argument for the assertion of the 7C exemption. But the thing that's bothering Judge Brown and me is you're not claiming the 7C exemption, you're claiming a Glomar response. They're not the same thing. You're saying we can neither confirm nor deny that we have it. You're not saying we have it, but it's protected.
That's correct,
Your Honor. You would seem to be in a much stronger position if you were coming in here and honestly saying, all right, this thing that everybody knows exists does exist, but we don't have to disclose it. We're having a hard time understanding why the government is taking such a, frankly, difficult-to-defend position when it looks as if you might have a very strong position otherwise.
These kinds of cases, as Judge Brown pointed out in her questioning, these kinds of cases are not unusual. And when a request comes in of this nature, this is how the DEA responds, because that's the way to protect the interests of the people whose
names
appear.
Doesn't make sense that we've always done it this way? Is that your position?
It's a little bit of what I just said, yeah. Your Honor, but in light of the Favish standard and the lack of any meaningful evidence here, it's just allegations of any government misconduct, whether you want to affirm on a Glomar or a straight, you know, under the rules of 7C, it's clear that Mr. Marino is not entitled to any additional information, and the district court's denial of his motion was correct.
It was another part of the government's position that frankly bothered me when the government says that the United States attorneys were not authorized to disclose the information that belonged to DEA. Apparently this came out in a criminal trial where the U.S. Attorney's Office was the attorney for the United States.
That's correct, and that's
an error. Do you really want us to start questioning the authority of the attorneys for the United States to act on behalf of their client?
No, Your Honor, that's an error in my brief.
Okay,
I apologize for that.
Thank you. I didn't want that one to be starting up there.
No, as I work in the U.S. Attorney's Office, sometimes the DEA seems farther away than it is, but we're all part of one big, happy Department of Justice.
They always did, counsel. There's nothing new. They were called BNDD in my day, but they still had the same.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the court affirm either the judgment or the denial of the Rule 60B motion, or both.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
If we were to remand this back to the district court, what would the district court do with this argument that you've raised that counsel here was neglective or ineffective? How would that be properly before the court? Could you raise that there? Or?
Which question, Your Honor?
The fact that counsel below failed to submit a response to summary judgment motion.
On remand, the district court would reach then the issue of gross attorney neglect, which is an extraordinary circumstance. So the district court would be determining whether or not the Rule 60 motion is satisfied. And
was that brought before the district court judge on the Rule 60 motion before?
Yes.
And he just chose not to reach.
In Marino's pro se Rule 60 motion, he did mention that there was gross attorney neglect. There are facts in the record which support that, Your Honor. And in the opposition to the Rule 60 motion, the government even called the attorney's behavior egregious.
Problem we've got for the application of that standard you're asking for, if we say, and we should, that a failure to file a response to summary judgment motion is attorney neglect, if we then grant the relief of considering the late, giving a new opportunity to file a motion, to file a response, we've eviscerated the local rule that says if you fail to file a response, it can be construed against, the motion can be construed against you. What's left of the rule if we follow that exception?
Your Honor, the teeth in the rule is really the requirement that the level of evidence to show how just how gross this attorney neglect has been. And in this case, it really is substantial. In the attorney's own motion for reconsideration, he stated that he had lost the brief that the response that he was going to file. He stated that he did not know what to do, so he ended up doing nothing. When prior he had filed two or three extensions of time, he could have easily filed an extension.
It seems that if we do that, then the worse the failure to comply with the rule, the greater the chance that the rule will not be enforced. It sort of eviscerates the rule, doesn't it, Counsel?
Well, Your Honor, the purpose behind Rule 60 here is not to punish.
What about the local rule that requires that the court can construe against the non-moving party the failure to file?
And I think, Your Honor, opposing counsel's suggestion that the bar deal with and discipline attorneys who are behaving in that manner is what's appropriate there. But the motivation behind a Rule 60 motion is not to punish a client for their attorney's gross negligence where they're not at fault, as in this case. If I may just mention one point, Your Honor, on the public interest, the Favre standard does require that the government misconduct be supported by evidence. But it is strange for opposing counsel to be raising to be raising that question here, where the DA motion for summary judgment said, which we're asking whether or not there's a defense to, said simply, the allegations notwithstanding, this is really just a private interest. So it seems like because their motion for summary judgment was really more of a motion to dismiss based on a very specific basis, which is not an accurate rule of law, then the Favish requirement for showing meeting that evidentiary standard does not need to come just yet. The district court on remand, after determining the Rule 60 motion, can then determine whether or not the public interest has been established. The government misconduct, Your Honor, has been established with the evidence. And beyond that, the balancing, the weighing, is yet another stage, which is too premature, given the motion for summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Ruiz. I want to thank you and the Georgetown Law Center Appellate Litigation Program for the representation. And we've been impressed with the program's quality, as we have in the past, Counsel. Case is submitted.